Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
Chico food service professional Colleen Phipps became involved with Butte County's National Alliance on Mental Health after one of her sons was convicted of second-degree murder and incarcerated. Colleen Phipps and her husband Larry kept a diary of their son's battle with mental illness. This diary is now a book about mental illness and criminalization, Walk Barefoot in the Mud for Me, written to bring awareness to those struggling with mental illness that they are not alone. Colleen Phipps, welcome.
Hi.
Now, you have the title of your book is Walk Barefoot in the Mud for Me, and that goes way back to before you even moved to Chico. How did that come about?
Well,
why did you move to Chico?
Well, we moved because my two oldest kids moved to California, and we wanted to be close to them. So we moved back to California, and Chico had a university, which I had been working at in Oregon. So I got a job here at Chico State, and we moved here.
Well, you say in your book that at that time your children were ages 6, 7, 9, 11, and 12, and they just loved living in Oregon. You say they loved slipping, sliding, sloshing, digging,
yes,
even riding dirt bikes in the mud.
Sure.
And so you moved that summer, 1979, and you came to you left for a drier, sunnier southern Oregon, but you say, as you look at this muddy stretch of garden soil and take off your shoes and you step into it and you feel mud slowly squish between your toes for Dawn.
Yes.
And who were you standing in the mud for? Who was Dawn?
Dawn is our second to youngest son, and he is the one who was incarcerated due to his mental illness. And when he was sentenced, he was the weekend after he was sentenced to prison, 32 years to life, we went to the jail, Butte County Jail, to visit him. And when I went in and talked to him, he said, you know, I'm kind of happy I'm going to prison. And he was still kind of delusional because they're going to have hot breakfast. And he said, one thing I want you to do for me is I want you to walk barefoot in the mud for me, because he knew he wouldn't be doing that. Sorry.
And this became the title of your book,
mm-hmm.
Walk Barefoot in the Mud for Me. And these are the words of your son, Don. Now, he had an encounter with the police before the reason he got incarcerated.
Yes.
And you tell about what happened before that time where there was an automobile accident. So what happened that he was having a hard time and your husband had to ask the police, don't shoot my son?
Oh, yes. That was an encounter in 1996 in which he was acting very bizarre. We had to call the police. We told him to do a 5150 to have him.
Oh, now that's
yes.
something that comes up often in your
yes.
book. Yeah, people might not. What did she say? 5150?
Sure. Yeah.
What is that?
That's unable to care for yourself and a danger to yourself or others. And he was being a danger. He was very psychotic. The police did come, and they actually brought in a SWAT team and surrounded the cottage next door to us where he was living, surrounded the house, started yelling at all of us in our house to go back to the other street because there might be shooting. Of course, we ran to the other side of the street, and my husband's running down the street saying, don't shoot my son, don't shoot my son, and they finally called me over there. And they said they want me to come inside and talk to Don. So I went in there, and there were three police officers with guns pointed at Don. They had me stand behind one who was crouched with a gun. And I looked at Don, and I said, Don, could you come out, please, and talk to me? And, you know, his whole demeanor changed, and it was like he heard me. And he looks at me and he says, not until I take care of these guys. Well, they heard that. They immediately pulled me away and started shooting him with beanbags. He eventually ended up, of course, in jail, not in the psychiatric unit, which we had asked. So he ended up going to jail. That particular incident caused an assault on a police officer because he threw a carpenter square out the window and it hit an officer that was outside. They had broken all the windows to get in and broke down the door. You know, it was a
now,
real
they broke down the door,
yeah.
And your husband had a key to the
door.
Oh,
yes. My husband was yelling, I have a key. But you see, understand that police are there and trained to do a certain thing in a certain way. And, of course, their training tells them exactly how to react and act. And so I understand. They did not allow any of that coming into their thinking. Of course, we are now doing some changes in that, because now we're starting to get training for police officers. You know, it's like when I talked to Don, when I talked in a calm manner, he calmed down. And had they learned that that could happen, they would have been able to calm the situation.
But
and
yet
that's
that
what
was
we're
not
doing.
Their training. And that was not, at that time, that was not their training.
No, and that was 20 years ago.
My guest is Colleen Phipps.
No, 25 years ago. Yeah, anyway.
Colleen Phipps and her husband kept diaries when their son was going through all this trauma that she's telling us about now. And she's put this in a book to help the rest of us. So on the very first page, chapter one, Colleen, you tell what happened that was so resulted in his being criminalized. Would you read that or tell us what happened on this date?
Yeah.
And this was in 1996.
No, this was the tragedy.
Yes. Okay.
And this was February 23rd, 2003.
Okay. This is when he killed the young man.
Yes.
Okay.
And reading from the book, someone is chasing Donovan. And he's almost certain it is those hoodlums he encountered at the AM-PM gas station. He anxiously drove away and is certain they are after him. He races down the Esplanade in his dad's 1989 faded white Ford Ranger pickup truck, sweat pouring down his face. His hair is unkempt, eyes bloodshot, pupils large, and he is mumbling and shaking his head. The voices in his head are scaring him. He looks in the rearview mirror and then back at the streetlight turning red and speeds through the intersection. Cars steer away, barely missing him as he swerves in and out down the colorful fall tree-lined street, racing faster, driving nearly 50 miles an hour through two more red light intersections. Panic increases. He wipes his brow. Fear spreads across his face. And before he realizes it, his truck is spinning around as he smashes directly into the side of a Nissan sedan. The impact of the crash causes his head to hit the steering wheel and dashboard, creating a gash on his forehead. When everything stops spinning, he manages to open his truck door and begins running without looking back. A young man in the Nissan sedan, Juan Lugo, dies immediately on the scene. Donovan is convicted of second-degree murder.
This is Colleen Phipps, and she's reading from her book, Walk Barefoot in the Mud, about what happened to her son in February of 2003. And she told us of a previous episode in 1996 when the police came and didn't understand how to deal with her son. And so I think that, Colleen, why you wrote this book, to help people understand how to cope with some situation like this.
Yes, you know, after my husband passed away in 2010, I started to type up all the letters that we had written and the yellow legal pads we had written things. And then last summer, my daughter talked me into putting that into a book and helped me format it. And I had the reason I wanted to do all of that was because I wanted other people who are going through this, and I've been getting phone calls, let me tell you. There are people going through this even now, 20 years later, to help them, for one thing, to better understand mental illness, to become educated in it, to speak out and advocate so that we start to make changes in the law. And we have. We have come a long way. We have a long ways to go, but we've come a long way. We have a mobile crisis unit, which we did not have then. We did have CIT-trained officers, which is crisis intervention team, but we don't right now have any, but we did about, 6 years ago. So we want to bring CIT back. But other than that, I think the community is becoming more understanding because they are, you know, you have a neighbor who might not understand, and it's very difficult.
Well, I think your book has already been helpful just on a small scale for me, Colleen, because I have this friend I've known for so many years, and I never knew she had a family member who was schizophrenic. And I listened to her story, and I realized what she was dealing with, her family is dealing with. So just on a small scale, I appreciate your writing this book. I know it was painful for you to write. I'm sure it was.
It was.
And then I even, as some of the things that you're just saying as an update of what is available now, I talked to a woman who was assistant director of Butte County Behavioral Health, who was assistant director at that time. And she remembers this incident. Of course, I didn't ask her any details because she can't talk about that. But she did mention some of the things that were being done.
Yeah, I'm very happy with NAMI. I'm the president. National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Yeah, because I did mention that in the introduction. But they did actually, earlier they used the term National Alliance for Mental Illness. And I noticed they reworded it to say National Alliance on Mental Health.
It's National Alliance on Mental Illness. Mm-hmm. It's a national.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you are the local president
still. Yeah.
Because I think you stepped aside for a while and now you're back.
A couple years. I started in 1996 when this all happened. We started NAMI, my husband and I. And some people say NAMI. I say NAMI, whatever. Apples, you know. And, you know, I just feel so good that we have a stake in behavioral health, Butte County and Enlow, that we have a good relationship with them and we're able to speak freely and help them to make changes. I just feel it's very powerful to speak. I think it helps, it helped me. And I encourage everyone who is going through anything similar, even small, to speak up because, you know, you never know who might be standing next to you in the grocery line who might be going through a similar thing. And and to feel not alone is incredible.
Yeah. You reproduce in your book articles that appeared in the Chico Enterprise Record. And there's a letter that Larry wrote to the editor of the Chico Enterprise Record. And he says, what do you do? And so he offers some suggestions. He says, as a member of NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, I've seen it many times. Very often those who think that way is suddenly stunned and shocked when mental illness strikes a member of their family. And so he has some suggestions about what to do. So what were Larry's suggestions in that letter to the editor? This is on page 131.
Oh, yes, this letter. I remember it. August 30th, 2004. So, it's an illness of the brain, after all, Larry says. Now, what to do? Don't be so quick to judge those with the illnesses. 2, call a NAMI representative and get some facts. 3, go to www.nami.org and check out the information available. 4, actively lobby for mental health improvement of facilities and treatment. 5, speak out against the criminalization of people with mental illness.
This is Chico author Colleen Phipps reading a letter that her husband Larry wrote to the Chico Enterprise Record in 2004. And her book is Walk Barefoot in the Mud for Me. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author Colleen Phipps, who has written a book about her son's battle with mental illness. So you offer suggestions. You suggest they get in touch with NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and you are active in that group still, which you and Larry helped found. You have suggestions as to what to do in your book, and then you say that you incorporated this organization, and then toward the end of your book, you reproduce a talk that you gave, and on page 178, this starts with the big question then is, would you read a couple of paragraphs there?
Yeah, this is, I've given this speech a lot to family members and those who have mental health issues because it's my story, not everybody else's story, but it's similar in some ways. I guess maybe it says here...
The big question is?
The big question then is how can this have been prevented? And how can we prevent this from happening to anyone else? 1, those with mental illness need to be taught how to deal with their illness, to accept it, and to recognize stressors. We need to help to bring supportive housing to our county so they are not alone. When they are well, have your loved one write a plan. Have a crisis information sheet available for if and when you need to call the police. And when you call 911, if available, ask for a CIT officer.
Now, I want to pause for just a second because people might not think of it. They call 911, and you're saying, but then ask for, and you just said what that CIT stands
for. Yes, CIT, Crisis Intervention Team. And I don't believe right now Butte County has any trained. We are in the process of having another training to train our, what are they called, the cadets that are at Butte College? Anyway, to have them go through the training before they even apply to become a police officer. And also become involved, committees, supervisors' meetings, legislators, letter-writing campaigns. Now, Laura's Law, oh my gosh, have I been an advocate for Laura's Law. Now, it says here, if we had had this in our county, our son would not be in prison, and a young man would not have lost his life. Laura's Law is a court-ordered assisted outpatient commitment for the seriously mentally ill who don't understand the gravity of their condition and who desperately need care, but do not meet the criteria for involuntary hospitalization, which is 5150. It's a way of getting help for family members before they become ill, so that they are become so ill that they are a danger to themselves or others. And let me say right here, so a year ago, the governor required every county to implement Laura's Law with no monies. But they said you could come up with an alternative. Our county came up with an alternative. That alternative, which isn't in the book, but that alternative is called the REST program. Resiliency, empowerment, something or other. Behavioral health has that information. So the REST program is similar. You can call, or a doctor can call, and have a team come out to the house and talk to this loved one who is delusional or experiencing extreme distress, and slowly build up a confidence with this person to help them to start to possibly start taking medication again, to start to get on the road to recovery. And that is why we have Everhart Village, because that is where they will eventually go and live. Everhart Village, you might have heard it on the news. It's very important to support the Everhart Village because it'll help some of those who are seriously mentally ill and need the help they can get. So it's an alternative to Laura's Law.
My guest is Colleen Phipps, and she is giving us suggestions of how to cope with a friend, family member, or any member of our community that is dealing with mental health. And these suggestions, I so appreciate the fact that you have put this in a book for us in this community, Colleen. Is there anything, any parting words you want to leave us with? Because there's so much more in your book. I encourage readers to pick up a copy because, for example, you produce the transcript of the trial that your son had to, that your whole family had to go through. And I found that interesting. I read every word of all this that you included in your diaries. But what parting words do you have for us?
I think I basically want to say I get phone calls every week because my number is the number for NAMI, Butte County. And consistently, probably listen. I do a lot of referrals. But I think the biggest thing is when anybody is going through this, whether they're the person who's going through it or a family member, is to listen. It's so welcoming to have somebody hear what you're saying. I think that's
and
a critical thing.
And often that's all the rest of us can do.
Yes.
There's nothing we can do to fix the situation.
Right.
But we can listen.
Absolutely. And that is help.
I think that's really good advice, Colleen.
You're not alone.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
My guest has been Colleen Phipps, and she is president of the National Alliance on Mental Health here in Butte County. And the title of her book is Walk Barefoot in the Mud for Me. My next guest has written and edited more than 100 children's books, comics, graphic novels, and memoirs. Rex Ogle was born and raised mostly in Texas. After college, he moved to New York City to intern at Marvel Comics. His first memoir, Free Lunch, won an award for excellence in nonfiction. His most recent book, Road Home, is also a memoir, and it takes place in the summer of 1998. Rex Ogle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did you have young adults in mind when you wrote this book?
Honestly, this is a story I never wanted to tell. This is something I had a lot of shame about, a lot of, you know, embarrassment. This is stuff I just, after it happened, I was not willing to share it with the world. And I went on to edit books, and I always wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write science fiction and fantasy. And I got hundreds and hundreds of rejections. And, you know, one editor one day was like, maybe you should try writing about yourself. And I was like, that's the last thing I want to write about. And he said to me, there are a lot of kids out there who, you know, could learn from your experiences. And I was like, they're not going to learn anything. It was a miserable childhood. And they're like, I disagree. You should give it a shot. And so I'd already been writing kids' books and comic books, so I always enjoyed it. I just never felt this was for a young adult teenage audience, but my publisher disagreed, so I wrote it.
You know, as I was reading your book, the title of your book is Road Home, but I was also thinking that if the title weren't already taken, you could call it The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Because I think your book contains all of that, good people, bad people, and ugly.
Yeah.
And I would like to remind listeners that what you wrote is nonfiction. So the story you're telling is what happened to you.
Yeah.
Now,
it's so weird. Like when I write fiction, I can talk about it for days. But when it comes to the nonfiction stuff, it's so weird because it happened to me and it feels, I don't know, like I'm naked in front of the world, like I'm burying myself. But that's exactly what it is. You know, you're sharing your story. You know, I mean, I feel like there are literally millions of homeless youth in our country, and a large majority of them are LGBTQ+, because either they've run away from home, they've been kicked out of their home, they're scared of people at school, you know, and they have a really hard time getting through that phase of their life. And I think there are some that just don't make it. And I don't think anyone's ever told a story like this. So I think it's important to kind of draw attention to this issue that's been pressing in our country for decades.
Well, it might be too that some adults who read this book think, oh my gosh, my childhood was like, not exactly like Rex's, but for example, when you mentioned your dad taking out his belt, I thought, oh my gosh, how many times have I heard that about adults my age who had childhoods like that, where their father beat them? And I think that might be helpful, if I want to use that word, for people to realize, oh gosh, I wasn't the only one.
Yeah. I wrote two other books, Free Lunch, which is for middle graders, middle school, which was about poverty and domestic violence, and then Punching Bag, which was just about domestic violence, and that took place during my high school years. And this is kind of like the trilogy. Like, I don't plan on writing about my life anymore after this, because it's really painful to revisit this stuff. But I think so many people live through this. It happens with such frequency. And I mean, I'm 45 now, but I know when I went to school in Texas in the 80s, like I remember first and second grade, I got hauled off to the principal's office and he took out a paddle. And he paddled me, and that was not, you know, out of the realm of this happens. Like, this was just like, you go to the principal's office, you get spanked. And now I know that would never happen. But I mean, I got beat on a pretty regular basis at home. And I just thought that was not normal. But, you know, I think getting spanked in the 80s was, I mean, it just happened. That was part of how kids were raised.
My guest is Rex Ogle, and we're going to be talking about his book, Road Home. And I didn't mention Alabama, but that's actually where your memoir begins. And why were you in Alabama?
So I was born and raised in Texas. My dad was in the Air Force. He split up with my mom when I was 5. And I never really had a relationship with him. And, you know, so I lived with a lot of stuff with my mom. She was mentally ill. Her husband was abusive. She was abusive. So when I was 16, I moved in with my abuela in Abilene, Texas. And then when I graduated from high school, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go get to know my dad. Like, I don't know this guy. He has been a stranger my whole life. I want to get to know him. So I moved there to spend time with him and get to know the father that I never had. And then this happened.
You know, in case people miss that word abuela, I thought of her when the title, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Good, because grandmothers are typically that way. They just love you in spite of anything. And so I'd like to repeat that you mentioned your abuela, your grandmother.
Yeah, she is, I mean, she was an angel in my life. She was always there for me. My parents weren't very capable, I guess, of being parents. I'm not mad about it. I don't hate them. I don't resent them anymore. I did when I was younger, but I forgave them a long time ago because my abuela was like, you can't hold on to hate. You can't hang on to anger for things that happen. You just have to let it go and move on with your life. And she was just an amazing, amazing woman. And you can find her pretty much in all of my books, nonfiction and fiction. I love that woman.
Well, I would like you to read the scene that is the reason you left home. And you mentioned your dad having been in the Air Force, and you have a stepsister. And she's one, if I want to have categories, good, bad, and the ugly, she's one of the good ones, your abuela, and then Rebecca, your stepsister. So what was the role that Rebecca played in your having to leave home in Alabama?
So she inadvertently outed me to my dad. I mean, I guess, you know, I confided in her. Like, I've been trying to figure out my sexuality my whole life. Like, you know, I grew up in the 80s and the early 90s during the AIDS epidemic. And I thought if I was gay, I automatically had AIDS and I would die alone. And it was terrifying to me as a boy, as an adolescent, as a teenager. And I really struggled with it. And it was really hard for me to confide in people, but I was pretty close with my stepsister. And so I told her, and she thought, you know what, I'm gonna tell my mom and tell dad, and I'll just ease them into it. And that's not what happened. So I'll read this bit.
Okay, please do that.
It's out. It's in the world. She said it, made it real. Now dad knows, which means my stepmom probably knows, which means I can't take it back. I don't even know if I want to take it back, even if the world does hate me, because it's been a secret as long as I've been alive. And I hate lying. I hate secrets. I hate keeping this part of me quiet just because it makes someone else uncomfortable. It's not fair. Dad turns on me, finally looking at my face. You have a choice. You can stay and be part of this family if, and only if, you abide by the following conditions. He says, one, you'll see a therapist every week at your own expense. He says, two, you attend church Wednesday night and twice on Sundays. I interrupt. You don't even go to church. Don't interrupt me, he shouts. He takes a breath. He says, three, you'll date a girl from church, one that I meet and approve of. Are you serious? Damn it, he says, pointing like he wants to hit me. I almost wish he would. That I'm not afraid of. I've been hit before, plenty of times. Not by him, but by my mom and stepdad. That's why I came to live here with my dad in Alabama. Violence doesn't scare me, but being cast out? Four, he continues, you will never again associate with the person of homosexual persuasion. No friends, no acquaintances, none of that. And five, for all intents and purposes, you will be straight. Is that understood? No, I whisper. I don't understand. You want me to repeat myself? I shake my head. No, I heard you, but it's not that easy, I whisper. It's not black and white for me. Not right now. I don't know who I am yet. I need time to figure it out. Well, you need to decide now. But I can't. Choose, he growls. Choose right now. And I can't. I know I can't. Because I say, it's not a choice. Of course it is, he snaps. Everything in life is a choice.
This is my guest, Rex Ogle. He's reading from his memoir, Road Home. And this was a conversation he had with his dad back in the summer of 1998. And he's so convinced that this is a choice that you have made. And I'm hoping that in today's culture that people know it's not a choice, and that going to a therapist is not going to change your orientation, if I want to put it that way. Is that an accurate assessment, do you think, Rex?
I think so. I mean, you know, I grew up in the 80s, and all I heard was, it's a choice, it's a choice. People choose this. They choose to be sinners. They choose to go to hell. You know, there was a lot of religious homosexuality when I was growing up. Again, Texas, the 80s, rural. You know, my dad came from a very religious family. They were Southern Baptists in the hills of Tennessee. And I think he truly believed that, you know, giving me that choice was him trying to help me. Like, he was coming from, I'm a father, I have to do what's best for my son, and I'm going to make him choose to be straight. And I just don't think he understood that. I mean,
yeah, because I was, even you quote him as saying, I'm not doing this for me, I'm doing this for you. Because if you're gay, you'll ruin your life. And so he thinks, it seems to me, that he's doing it for the best reasons.
Yes. And I think it took me a while. I think in my late 20s, I just one day realized, I was like, he had no malicious intent. Like, if he had cast me out to be cruel, to be mean, I mean, that's one thing. But, you know, my parents, as with, I think, most people's parents, are trying their best. And, I mean, their best doesn't always add up, but I think they're trying. And like I said, he was coming from a good place, however misguided that was.
So he gives you 24 hours to make up your mind. And so your decision was?
You know, my decision, I always had this thing about being controlled. And I think part of that was growing up around domestic violence. Like, I always felt helpless. And in this moment, I was like, I'm not helpless anymore. Like, I can make a choice, not to be gay, but to be myself. And I was like, this is who I am. I need to stick by it. I don't want to pretend to be someone I'm not. So I told my dad that. I was like, I do not want to leave. I want to be part of your family. I love y'all. I want to stay, but I need to be myself. And he was like, then that's your choice. And so I left.
And poor Rebecca, our heart goes out to her, because she was so upset that you were having to leave. And she was so sorry. And because she thought if she told your dad, he'd be okay with it. And that wasn't the case.
She did.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with memoirist Rex Ogle. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, memoirist Rex Ogle. Then you leave your home in Alabama, and you go to New Orleans, or Nolens. What took you to New Orleans?
So, you know, I've always been a reader, and at the time I was reading Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, and I had been really taken into that world. It's a beautiful series. It's well written. And Anne Rice does such an amazing job of just describing New Orleans. And she makes it feel like a very mysterious, magical place. And I was drawn to New Orleans. I'd never been there. And a couple weeks before all this stuff happened with my dad, I'd actually gone there with some of my coworkers from Walmart, where I was working at the time. And we went to Pensacola Beach. And while I was there, I met a guy while I was swimming out in the ocean, and we talked, and I mean, he told me I was cute. I didn't know how to take that. I mean, obviously it felt like magical. It felt like I was meeting Prince Charming out here amongst the waves. But then I swam away because my friends, you know, my coworkers were very Christian, and I didn't know their stance on homosexuality, but I know that they were, one of them was very against sex before marriage, so I just assumed. And But that night I ran into him again in the hotel lobby late at night when I couldn't sleep, and had my first kiss with him. And he gave me his number and was like, if you're ever in New Orleans. So when my dad gave me that choice, I was like, I have nowhere else to go. So I am going to go where Anne Rice has told me to go and where this handsome man has told me to go. And I'm going to go to New Orleans.
My guest is Rex Ogle, and he is author and editor and publisher of many books. The one we're talking about right now is his memoir, Road Home. And so there you're off to New Orleans. You do have a truck because you've been working. You've worked most of your life as a young man. How old were you?
17.
That's just hard to imagine. The decisions and the choices I would have made at age 17, I would think, oh my gosh, what was I thinking? And sometimes when we're reading your book, here you are, just a 17-year-old. Your birthday does come up in the book. Mm-hmm. And you think, oh, Rex, why did you do that?
Yeah.
But you were a teenager.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I, you know, from an early age, I was like, I'm a smart kid. I'm smarter than everyone else. I mean, no, I didn't actually think I was smarter. I thought I was wiser.
Oh, there's a difference there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Because there were kids who, you know, made great grades and didn't have to try. And I always had to try at everything. Nothing. I felt like I had no skills. I was trailer trash from Texas. I grew up in government subsidized housing, on welfare, on food stamps. Like I never thought I would amount to much in this world, but I did think I was wise because there was a lot of death early on, the poverty, the domestic violence. Like, you had to get crafty, you had to get inventive to survive day to day. And so, yeah, 17, I thought I was, you know, 17 going on 250. And I was like, I can do this. I can figure this out. I'll land on my feet.
Well, one thing that I much of your book, I mean, it was a real page turner, I thought, well written, and it really helped me to better understand what the experience of a homeless person is like, because I don't have conversations with them. There are many of them here in Chico. I mean, the problem just gets worse and worse. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really understand what their day-to-day life was like. About one thing I wondered was, don't they get bored all day long? And you even mentioned at one point that you would tie and untie your shoelaces or something to do.
Yeah. And I mean, I had a backpack with me, and I had Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire with me. And I mean, I read that book over and over, but there were times that I just felt like an animal. I literally felt like a lion on the Serengeti Plain of Africa, just waiting for its prey. And by prey, I mean, where's my next meal going to come from? And it's not so much that I was bored, which I was, but at times I just felt tired, because New Orleans in the summer, I mean, this was a really bad choice on my part, but this was before the internet. I did not know how to check out the weather for the summer. It is hot. It is humid. It is sweltering. It is suffocating. And to be thirsty in that, to be hungry in that, you go into this kind of, I don't even know how to put it, like a fugue state. And you don't think about much. You think, where am I going to drink water? Where am I going to find food? Where am I going to sleep tonight? And that's pretty the only three things that I was thinking most of the day.
But you did look for work. You had a job in Walmart, and you thought, well, I'll just get a job in New Orleans. And you, by the way, you had a truck. That's how you got from Prattville, Arkansas to New Orleans. But it came in handy to know that that's where you could park your truck when you were looking for a job. You could park way out in the back in the parking lot at Walmart, and you wouldn't get your truck towed.
Yeah, because working at Walmart, you kind of know, you know, if you work there, you park in the back of the parking lot. And, you know, Walmarts that are open 24/7 will always have cars in the back of the parking lot. And knowing I couldn't just drive around all day, every day, running the air conditioner, I knew I had to park my truck somewhere safe. So I parked it in the Walmart parking lot and then walked up and down streets looking for jobs. And, you know, I've been working since I was 12, you know, cutting lumber wood or carrying up groceries for neighbors, you know, to earn a nickel or a dime, babysitting. I started working when I was 15 in a video store, later a Cracker Barrel, Food World, Walmart. I mean, the list goes on. But yeah, so I was like, it'll be easy for me to find a job when I get to New Orleans. I'll just, you know, and then I got there and I was like, well, I can't transfer Walmart to Walmart because I never showed up. So I'm sure I'm fired. But
and when you're applying for jobs too, you have to have an address and a phone number they can contact you. And that was a problem. But you run into a person your age, Sydney.
Yeah.
And she was homeless for a different reason. Why was she homeless?
You know, everyone has their different circumstances. Hers was that she'd gotten pregnant at an early age, and her mom was not going to put up with that, not for one second. And she was out of there. And so she found herself in a very similar situation to me.
So you got tips of how to feed yourself. Oh, my goodness. Like digging French fries out of a trash can and how to get pancakes. So there, a lot of your book is about how you survived being homeless. And we typically think of the homeless as sleeping under a bridge. I mean, that you had to do that also. There was times when you slept under a bridge, Rex.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of bridges, I don't know if I should tell people that what happens after you've been through so much. You actually climbed upon a bridge. And what were you thinking?
I mean, keep in mind, this was 3 months of violence, fear, hunger, desperate loneliness, assault, you know, seeing people on drugs, which thank God I was smart enough not to fall into that.
Well, there's where I thought of the good, bad, and the ugly. Some of these characters you're just referring to now, gosh.
But I got up on the bridge and I was just done. I couldn't. I was tired. I didn't know where to go, what to do, where to go. You know, keep in mind this was before the internet. There were no cell phones back then. I didn't know there were resources. I'm sure there was one or two resources, but not like today where you just Google homeless youth and, you know, things come up. But I was on that bridge feeling utterly alone.
Speaking of feeling alone, you meet this older gentleman, and he's a gentleman, and he, his name was Roger, and he issues a warning, I think, for young people. He says, when you get to be my age, when you're a homosexual man, if you don't have a partner or friends or family because you've wasted your life pretending to be something you're not, you end up alone. And I think that's kind of a lesson there for young people.
Mm-hmm. It was a different generation. I think these young kids are growing up. Oh my gosh, in a wonderful, beautiful world. I mean, keep in mind, there are still hate crimes and homophobia and banned books. But the world is getting a little better day by day, piece by piece. And I do see a lot of gay youth coming up, you know, not scared of HIV, not scared of being gay bashed. I mean, they have more resources, they have more community, but there's still a lot that don't. Especially those kids in rural areas or, you know, in religious families. There are still kids who are suffering.
Yeah, and I think you end on an optimistic note. And I felt optimistic when I, even though it was hard going through some of your book, but these are the things that you end your book with, Rex. I have been lucky. I've had a full life, and my life is not over yet. Thank you for writing this book, Rex.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been amazing. Thank you.
My guest has been Rex Ogle. His book is Road Home. I would also like to thank my first guest, Chico author Colleen Phipps, whose book is Walk Barefoot in the Mud for Me. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
ode to oddness. We slept beside freeway on-ramps, sheltered by tall weeds. We hid from cops all night, hitched rides with farmers, religious cults, drunk truck drivers who passed on the road's shoulder, kind folks and angel dust heads. We learned to drive at 40. We're the odd. We rescue twirling bees in swimming pools, catch indoor spiders in cups, free them on shrubs, break for butterflies and crows. We're the odd. We tune out the Super Bowl, run from its monotonal buzz, prefer Walt Whitman to a quarterback, can't define a line of scrimmage. We're the odd. We loved weird Spider-Man, science nerd gone super, but still bookish, bullied like we were and forced to hide his strength, running through shadows from everyone who blamed him. We're the odd. We love broccoli. Its green flowers taste like topsoil. It's better than bacon, that sizzling flesh that clogs people with salty fat. We're the odd. We thrive on loneliness, find shelter in basalt canyons, where orange poppies and blue lupins thrive, and dusk caresses our skin. We wail with stars. We're the odd. Our words have their own shapes and colors, don't mix with jigsaw language that everyone else understands. We're one version of the odd, but celebrate. You're weird too. Paul Beltz.
Haiku for spring. Hushed, warming movement, was it black butterfly or green maple leaving? Dogwood bursts in joy, its sudden song of pink an affirmation, him. Bird notes arching high, cross blue matching chorus of blooming, hatching life. Easter Sonata. Once again, nature hogs us, renewing Earth's faith. Happiness. Wishes for you in this natal time, shared with bounty, spring. I'm Jenny Crawford.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.